طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. Amira Hahas is the only Jewish Israeli journalist to have lived among the Palestinians in Gaza and Ramallah since 1993. She thinks it is as necessary as covering Britain from London and France from Paris. Her reports from the Israeli daily Haaretz, which she says cannot be objective, just as any reporting about wrongdoing cannot be objective, have won her enemies in all camps. Forced by Hamas to leave Gaza earlier than planned in 2008, she was detained in Israel twice for entering Gaza without a permit and staying in an, quote, enemy entity, unquote. Amira Hass is an amazing, courageous journalist who was our featured presenter this morning. Speaking before the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs annual conference, we begin with her introduction at the Washington Press Club.
Thank you, Faisal. Welcome, Amira. Welcome, everybody. Amira Hass has been reporting for Haaretz on Israeli occupation in the West Bank and Gaza since the early 90s. And she also lived in Gaza from 1993 to 1997, and ever since then, she's been living in El Bira, Palestine. She's the author of Drinking the Sea at Gaza and two compilations of articles of Haaretz and Italian Weekly International. She was born in Jerusalem in 1956 and studied history in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv universities. Amira has also joined and was active in the left-wing groups while in high school. So welcome, Amira. Good to see you again.
Yes, even virtually, yeah. Good Sunday for all of you, yeah.
Thank you, Amira. To start with, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about yourself personally. Tell us a little bit about your family, where you grew up, and how did you get to where you are now?
In very short, I'm a red diapered baby. So where I am now is not a big thing, or is not a big a surprise, or a turn in my life. It's I feel that I follow for 65, 66 years the basics into which I was born. And one of those basics is the contradiction, is a permanent contradiction and very painful one. I was born to immigrants. I was born to refugees from post-Second World War Europe, who survived concentration camps and ghettos and realized that on the one hand, they were not welcome back in their respective societies in Eastern Europe. And also they discovered that all their families and close friends were killed by the German occupation. And even though they were not Zionists, you can say they were also even anti-Zionists because they were communists, they looked for a refuge. They looked for another place in the diaspora. and they emigrated to Palestine, Israel. It was after the establishment of the state. And I think this realization of the contradiction has become stronger and stronger over their lives, and also in my life. But I was born here in Jerusalem. And as I said, I was active in as a child. I was taken to all the demonstrations against the Israeli military rule and against other things. My father was arrested several times. My mother, I remember police coming to the house to look to arrest her because she had distributed leaflets against Ben Gurion. So this was more or less the background of my upbringing. So I'm not a rebellious person at all, because I follow this track.
Okay, well, thank you. Amira, you recently wrote a very striking article, and I'm just going to quote a paragraph from that article, and then I'm going to ask you to elaborate on what you wrote in more details and examples. In your article, you said, "On 1,000 fronts and more, Israel is fighting against the Palestinians, armed soldiers and policemen, bureaucrats and inspectors, architects, right-wing non-governmental organizations, all are soldiers of the state, and they are too many to count. The vanguard and the rear guard in every battle, the state prosecutor's office, the legal advisors, and the judges." Sounds very ominous.
And unfortunately, very accurate. And I wrote this both as a journalist and as an activist in spirit, and somebody who follows my fellow Israeli activists and Palestinian activists and human rights defenders, both Israelis and Palestinians and internationals. We have to follow so many cases, and we have to confront so many attacks against Palestinians, and we don't have the people to confront and to work in all those fronts, while the state has so many people and so many ammunitions and so many laws and so many judges to support it in so many kinds of warfare that it conducts every day, every minute.
Who orchestrates all this? I mean, is there some sort of a secret command center somewhere that has a huge 55 monitors on the wall, and then they watch what they're doing to children here, what they're doing to olive farmers there, what they're doing, what settlers they're sending to terrorize people, and what things they're confiscating, what houses they're blowing up? Is there some sort of a secret central command for that, or who coordinates all this huge effort against Palestinians on a day-to-day basis?
There is central command, but it's not secret. And beside the central command, there is the spirit that guides so many others. And there is also what I call a plane without a pilot. There are also things done without a pilot. It's already in the DNA of the system. So, if you have a policeman in Jerusalem harassing a Palestinian, it's not that this policeman got an order to act so. He or she feel free to harass, because this is the bon ton, or this is allowed, and this is always has the explanations. But when Israeli soldiers accompany a bureaucrat to hand a demolition order of one shack in the Jordan Valley, or to confiscate the tractor of a farmer, This is done by within the system, within the orders of what is called the civil administration, which is the main military arm that executes Israeli policies against Israeli government policies against Palestinians in the West Bank. So it's a combination. It's not just one center that decides about everything, but it's there are more than several centers. There are the centers of the. We know, for example, that there are the plethora of new outposts and outposts of shepherds that have been established illegally, even according to Israeli very lenient laws. So these have been established in the past 20 years and more so in the past 10 years. We know that they are being that their establishment is being orchestrated by one, if not more, organizations of settlers, very strong ones that, on the one hand, act as if they are independent of the government. On the other hand, we know that they get a lot of support from governmental institutions. So you have a chain of such centers that act against the Palestinians and against their rights. And they all both lean on an atmosphere, an anti-Palestinian atmosphere, and nurture it. And this atmosphere, so all kind of small clogs in the system feel free to improvise.
You mentioned that the state prosecutors and the like are an important cog in that wheel. Yesterday, we screened a film called The Law in These Parts by Ranan Alexandrovich. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that film.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and that film really delved really very deeply in how Israel engineered some sort of a legal system that it's cobbled together to satisfy its need to control the West Bank populations and to steal the land of the Palestinians. What can you tell us about how that system works and how it's working, and to what extent do you think there's any semblance of compliance with international law?
I'm not very well versed with the world of law and part of it is because it is so cynically it has been used so cynically against justice that at some point you stop, you know, you don't want to enter their own explanations because they seem so hollow. But what I can say from having followed mostly the Supreme Court, the Israeli Supreme Court or High Court of Justice over the years, is that they try to deal only with, you know, at some points to individual cases, they are afraid as if it were fire from concepts such as equality and fairness. They don't want to touch it. They did not, from the start, they refused to intervene with the issues of settlements, the illegality of settlements based on international law. They only rule against settlements when they are built on private land, privately owned land. But this is a catch, because Israel stopped in 67. It stopped the process of registering land in the West Bank according to ownership, or is it whether public or whether private. So it stopped the process. And only in 30% of the West Bank did the Jordanian authorities complete the process of registration. So the Israeli legal system allowed this massive theft of land based on the concept of public land. So every land that is not private is public, or actually state land, which means land of for the Jews. So they gave a hand to this unjust or open under full daylight robbery of land. Land doesn't have to be private in order to be to belong to the Palestinian people. I mean, the concept that only Palestinians have the right to their land only if it's registered as private is really obscene. But the Israeli judges allowed for this process to continue. For example, there were quite a few petitions against what is obvious, the discrimination in planning in the West Bank, whereby Israel planned settlements, at the same time did not allow Palestinian communities to develop their own master plans and to build. But the judges always refused to even address this issue of non-equality in planning. So it turns out that Palestinians who live for generations in a certain place are not allowed to connect to the water grid or to the electricity grid, because there is no master plan which would allow them to connect. While a 10 years old settlement already has water in abundance and an electricity and roads, etc. But the judges, they were not concerned with this. They always found ways to evade it. Judges also ruled already that it was the end of the 70s, no, the end of the 80s, I don't remember now exactly, yeah. They ruled the Jerusalemites, Palestinians who were born in Jerusalem and have been absent for many years, will be considered like as non-Jews who chose to live in the country. So once they leave the country, they lose their residency status. But the people were born in Jerusalem. They lived in Jerusalem. Their parents are from Jerusalem, their grandparents. And still, if they dared to be absent for some time, they would lose their residency right, residency status. And this was a ruling by the famous Aharon Barak, who is considered by the right wing, the Israeli right wing, as the legal activist. The one who promoted legal activism. But he is the one who ruled such a discriminatory took such a discriminatory ruling against Palestinians who are Jerusalemites. So this is in, you know, like we can continue and go on and on and on to high court licensing and allowing mass demolitions of houses as collective revenge against people who committed or who were suspected of committing attacks against Israelis. And so this is a complete complicity of the Israeli legal system with the occupation, totally ignoring or avoiding to tackle the principles of international law.
Thank you. Just going back to the 1,000 fronts concept is, has there been any effort mounted to actually document those 1,000 or whatever number it is, fronts that Israel is waging a war against the Palestinian on? And if it hasn't been, What would it take to do that? And what is the scale of that effort? And how do we get it off the ground?
Look, of course, when I wrote 1,000, this kind of, it was, you know, it can be 1,200 or 2,000. It was kind of I took the poetic license of using this term. There are many groups that document. I mean, there is a lot of documentation. You know, the B'Tselem organization, there are mostly in Gaza, there are two good organizations that document Israeli attacks you know, all kinds of attacks, not necessarily by military, but attacks against the rights of the Palestinians. So it's El Mizan and the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, and they are documenting things very meticulously. There are Israeli groups such as Hamoked, the Center for the Defense of the Rights of the Individual, which are documenting very thoroughly and systematically Israeli violations of international law and Israeli routine attacks against Palestinians. So we are not, you know, this is not an issue. Documentation and information are in abundance. It's really, there is no way that Israelis can say, oh, we didn't know. There is no way. And now with Facebook, you have activists who document so many incidents where settlers, for example, attack Palestinians, or where Israeli military helps settlers to chase away Palestinian farmers or Palestinian shepherds from their lands. So this is, I mean, you know, in order to go to court, we have more than enough about such proof of such attacks in all the fronts.
It's true, but I think it will be kind of nice and convenient to have some binder that says the 1,001 Israeli violations that Israel does on a daily basis, and that book can be published and distributed more so outside of Israel, so that the world would become aware of all that. I know they're aware of some.
Look, yeah. if you go to the website of Hamoked, is one of my favorite organizations, I must say, because one of their real great struggles, legal struggles, are about the regulations within the lands that were locked outside of the wall, of the separation wall. So if you go into their website, and I really encourage you to do so, you see they have a timeline where they bring examples of some of those fronts, and both cover it historically from the start and what is happening today and what are Israeli new measures in each field. So it's called Hamoked. Hamoked.
What's the link for that?
The center. Yeah.
There it is. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Somebody put up
there. And this is very useful. This is very useful. So they don't call it the fronts as I did, but these are some of the fronts and some of the and many examples and many cases in each front that show us the gravity of Israeli attack against Palestinians.
Thank you. There has been a recent development, and I'm just quoting here from that the Israeli army, the least moral army in the world, has changed its rules of engagement and will allow soldiers to shoot at anyone who, in their opinion, based on their on-the-spot decision, had thrown stones or firebombs some minutes earlier, including children. So this is really very serious. And giving a license to soldiers to do this, is shocking. And so could you tell us, you know, how this came about and what we expect to see now?
There has been a campaign of the right wing against Israeli rules of military rules of engagement, as if they were very strict, following the death of an Israeli soldier in Gaza, not in Gaza, he was outside of Gaza, and he was among the soldiers who were shooting at Palestinian demonstrators, and then one Palestinian found a small hole in the wall and then shot and killed him. And I guess not only since then, but already before, they demanding more tough hand against what they say Israelis who are Palestinians who throw stones or Molotov cocktails. But I must say that even before this change of rules of engagement, Israeli soldiers did feel free to shoot not only on the spot. But there was another change in Israeli rules of engagement, allowing soldiers to shoot at people that they suspect came to steal ammunition from military bases. And this really backfired just a week ago when two officers were killed by friendly fire because they were suspected by another soldier that they were some Palestinians who came to steal weapons. So this leniency already cost the army two of their officers. As I said, I mean, this even without the change, soldiers felt free to shoot. But now, of course, they can claim at a certain moment, they can claim that, oh, the child just threw stones, so they can shoot at him. And of course, there can be more casualties than there are today. As I said before, there is this atmosphere atmosphere that the life of Palestinians is cheap. So soldiers do act according to this atmosphere, to this unspoken directive. So far, I don't think that since the change, there have been such they were shooting and killing demonstrators in Beta, people who protest the establishment of an outpost and then a military position on their lands. This is happening, and even before the change. And I just wrote two months ago about a child who indeed intended to throw a Molotov cocktail, but the soldiers had all the ways to stop him before and not to kill him, and they did it. Yes, but maybe the fact that two soldiers were killed by this leniency, because of this leniency, will force them to think again about this change. Though, again, the soldiers feel on the field, in the spot, the soldiers always feel quite sure that even if they kill and when they kill, they are being protected by the army. Whether they were in danger, which usually they are not in danger, and whether they were not in danger, which is the rule.
I find it very shocking that it says there that they can kill people, including children, who threw stones a little while earlier. So it's not like to kill somebody while they're throwing stones at you and you're doing it in self-defense. Never mind, you know, the asymmetry, the lack of symmetry between a rifle and a stone. But it also allowing them to shoot somebody when that person presents no immediate danger. Like they threw a stone at them 5 minutes ago. They can go find them and then kill them. Because they threw stones at them 5 minutes ago. That's definitely extrajudicial justice. And I don't know of any...
I totally agree, yeah.
Yeah, of anybody in the world who would agree with this. And the shocking thing is, you know, that the United States supports Israel and allows Israel to do all kinds of things, and they look the other way. Now, do you, in your opinion, do you believe that the U.S., and people in Congress are aware of this kind of activity that goes on in Israel?
You know, I should ask you because you are the you are in America, and I'm not. You know, what's terrible is that you know, Israel does think in this gradual, silent way, so we don't see the. How extreme it is, because we do see, but I mean, in general, people outside of our circles don't see they have grown accustomed to this graduality, so they are not shocked. And I guess it is true about many many statesmen or politicians in America, in Europe, that if what you quoted now, the change of the amendment in the rules of engagement, that got very little attention in Israel, really very little attention in Israel, if it's something that we knew about Russia or China, this would have received a lot of criticism. And from top echelons in those countries, but not when it is Israel. And this is really disgusting. This forgiveness to Israel is and this impunity of Israel that the whole world is involved in is indeed very repulsive. And dangerous.
Thank you, Amira. I'm going to give Yusuf Aboudi a chance. He had a couple of questions he wanted to ask. And then after that, we'll look at the questions from the audience. And Nancy, at that point, can help us with looking through them and fielding some of those questions. Yusuf?
It's always dangerous for you to give me the mic there because that could take up 2 hours. So, but let me just... So earlier you had mentioned on the sanctioned versus unsanctioned behaviors of people, and you had used the example of the soldier in Jerusalem that would go out of his way just to abuse a Palestinian, and there's no particular central command that gave him that order, and it's just a behavior perspective that happens because it's ingrained within society. Have you seen any change in that kind of behavior and that kind of ingrained behavior within society over there? And do you believe that with the world being as connected as it is and the information readily available, would that change expedite and would that change the mannerism of central command?
Look, when we look at the Israeli youth, Israeli high school students and university students, they are certainly more to the right wing than their parents or grandparents were. I mean, I would say it's not that they were, that their grandparents were ever supporters of Palestinian rights, but still they were shocked. They probably were shocked or were embarrassed to be exposed with facts about killing people, killing children, etc. Now there is an atmosphere of indifference or even support, and this is our right, etc. And I just had in one of those in another webinar that I participated with an Israeli group, Ir Amim, that focuses on Jerusalem. So I was told later by the director that their experience with high school students is really very depressing, because they are so supportive of the most oppressive and repressive Israeli policies without seeing anything wrong about it. Look, information and knowledge are not the problem, as I said, unlike things that happened 80 years ago, 70 years ago, both in Palestine and outside of Palestine. We are drowning in information. We have too much information. So the issue is not about information. It's about the refusal to know or the refusal to or the indifference, whether you know or you don't know. It's not seen as a reason to object to something, even if you know how, even if you know. So like what we have raised upon as some kind of set of values is not the set of values that guides people today, so it seems. So to kill a child, to demolish a home, to steal the land, to not to give Palestinians access to water, it doesn't shock people. And it doesn't shock politicians in Europe and the States. They could say, oh, there are atrocities much worse than this. Or there is a Palestinian PA, so let them deal with it. It's not our business or whatever. Or we have other concerns to deal with. So it is not taken as a reason to use diplomatic and political means in order to check Israel.
Do you think that behavior from international community is that this is old news, it's boring, we don't want to deal with it, it's ongoing?
Look, I guess there are many reasons, and I guess that I'm sure that there is indifference and kind of blindness or refusal to see or to deal with other atrocities in the world. We are not the only evil place in the world. I mean, there are other atrocities, and it's always connected to political considerations. So probably it's for political considerations, Biden is more free to criticize China or Putin or whatever, but not Israel. And the same goes with states like England or France or Germany. And of course, Germany and France and England would always use the pretext of the Nazi period, actually using the murder of my family and so many other people as an explanation why to allow Israel to repress and to oppress and to expel and to kill Palestinians, which is really I use often the word here repulsive and disgusting, but I should use everything that you have in the dictionary to say the same thing.
Yes, thank you for all the enlightening comments.
Thank you, Amira.
Yeah, and thank you, Amira, for appearing today and being so free with your answers. So we have a number of questions that ask the same thing. So I'm going to focus on the questions of Barash Abed El Hal. And he asks, among other things, that people, it seems that the Israelis are not seeing at all the connection between the Holocaust and the Nakba. Number one, do you think that that's true? And number two, Is it because they don't want to, or because it makes it so that that the similarity of taking over and the justification for taking over the land will be abided if they see that similarity?
Look, the connection, I think that everybody, many people see the connection. It doesn't mean that they see a similarity or that there is a similarity. We don't need to compare things in order to, or to compare historical mess, injustices in order to be against them. The connection is, first of all, historical. It is a contextual. It is a sequence. I mean, before Hitler came to power and before Nazi Germany controlled Europe, only a minority among Jews chose supported the Zionist way. Most of the Jews, whether they felt persecuted for economical reasons or religious reasons or national reasons, they look for other ways to escape their to escape this situation. So they would emigrate to other countries. They would fight in socialist or communist movements. They would prefer to be in kind to remain religious or to assimilate, all kinds of solutions they found. But when they were a people, or we are a people of a diaspora, and we felt comfortable in the diaspora, only that what the Nazi Germany proved, that the diaspora did not want us. I'm sure that if in 1924 United States did not change its immigration laws, and many of the Jews who did emigrate to Palestine would have emigrated to the States. So this connection exists. It's very clear. And now, if we are talking about values and moral and ethics, people would say, oh, we were persecuted, so of course we were defending our lives here in Palestine, Israel. That's what many people think. People think that the Israeli army had the right, or the Jewish groups, Jewish military had the right to fight for their life. And people do think that that we have a right over this country. So the connection exists and people cannot ignore it. The tragedy is, and what infuriates is, that they don't make the moral connection or the moral association, an ethical one, that no matter what the oppression, the expulsion of an entire people from their land, is something that unacceptable. We are in post-colonial times, and we continue to do it. I mean, Israeli Jewish Zionism gains from its being anachronistic, because we came very late, as Zionism developed as a colonialist movement very late, and continued and bypassed the times when other colonized countries managed to free themselves. So the more we proceed, you know, like the more we proceed, the Israelis, the great majority of Israelis, unfortunately, Israeli Jews, feel comfortable. Maybe they feel threatened, so they go and arrange for themselves to have foreign passports, but not because they are politically, it's not political engagement against Israeli policies. They look for a personal way to flee from the place, or to escape the hardships.
Thank you so much. A. Helly is how he or she writes her name, points out, and I quote, "Privately owned and registered land versus collective ownership as a colonial territorialist imperative has existed in other nations of colonial times, the US among them before it became the US, Australia, et cetera, as opposed to collectively owned land. Now we know that in Israel, one movement in the origination of the land of Israel, the country of Israel, was a focus on kibbutzim, which are collectively owned. So why do they not see the connection between something that they started and collectively owned land rather than land that has to be registered in Palestine?
Because colonizers will use every method to get to take over the land. I mean, it is a very good point, because it's like that Israel respects all of a sudden, when it comes to Palestinians, Israel respects the sanctity of private property, so that only when it's Palestinians they are connected to private property, but does not acknowledge their right for collective property. But they are, you know, they can use one and the opposite in order to achieve their aim of expelling Palestinians, more Palestinians, or condensing them in the Bantustans that have been created in the West Bank over the past 30, 40 years.
Excuse me for a second. Amira, I'm going to just change the subject for a moment here, and we don't want to spend a lot of time on this question, but wanted to just get a quick take from you on the relationship between the PA and Israel. Are there things that we don't know about that you know that you can tell us about that?
Look, there are things that we see, of course. You know, I feel a bit uncomfortable to speak about it as an Israeli Jew. Mm-hmm. It's not easy, you know, like I'm not among of the people. There are people who say, oh, they are collaborators, or it's like they are like the South Lebanon army. And I feel a bit, I mean, I prefer to analyze and not to give names. What I can say is that there is they are at certain points, they act for sure as subcontractors of the Israeli occupation, and they also act as managers of Palestinian life in the enclaves that Israel has created over the past 30 years under the guise of the Oslo Agreement. So they are responsible for taking care of everything, of all the duties that, according to international law, was supposed to be taken by the occupying power. And that's why subcontractor might be a good definition. To what extent it comes to security cooperation, how detailed it is, we can only guess. You can believe me, you can imagine that I'm not being that these secrets are not being shared with us. Sometimes the Israeli security gives compliments to the PA for being so faithful in this exchange of security information and doing security stuff. It's not just about the relationship, but it's about a nomenclatura that has developed here. A strata of bureaucrats around Fatah that benefit from this status quo. Personally, they get promoted, they get salaries, they get access to property, to lands, etc. And by the way, the same is true about Gaza, as people say. So the same development of a Palestinian bureaucratic strata has developed also there that benefits from a certain status quo of the split between the two areas and the political split. And more than that, there are people, hundreds or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of families that have become dependent on the relationship, very, very logical relationship with the PA as the main service giver. So you have teachers and you have doctors and you have engineers, etc., etc., who all connected to this reality of PA. And they don't want it to fall because this fall means also their plight. And in this reality, in this status quo, when people do not see any possibility of a positive change, if there is a third intifada against the Israeli occupation, most of the people understand that this will not be in favor of the Palestinians, so they cling to this status quo and to the PA.
Thank you. Nancy?
Thank you. Thank you so much. Amira, there was an article, I believe, published by you in Haaretz on January 18th about Israel holding up spare parts for Palestinian water and sewage systems. As well as that, we seem to focus in the world and accept the fact that there is apartheid, an apartheid system in Palestine. Okay, but beyond that, when apartheid was supposedly defeated in South Africa, shortly after that, people started talking about economic, academic, and political apartheid as well. Just as in South Africa, it's very difficult for people in Palestine to get the same jobs, to get the same hospital treatment, medical treatment, education, etc. Why is the press not focusing more on that type of apartheid when actual political apartheid is already accepted in the world?
You know, we can call it many things. I see it's not just apartheid. It's really an economical war of attrition that Israel has been waging against the Palestinians from before Oslo. And it is waging it now against the PA and against Gaza. And this is one of the basics of Israeli regime against the Palestinians. We can call it war of attrition. We can call it, this is the best, for me, this is the best definition I can have, because to say economical apartheid, you know, I think that economical apartheid is more, an apartheid is more adequate to describe the reality in Israel proper. While when we talk about Gaza and the West Bank, I think it's a hybrid reality. It's a hybrid situation. I'm not an academic, so I don't feel obliged by one definition only or a binary definition. In Gaza and the West Bank, I think that still the colonialist process is ongoing. In apartheid, still the people are, the blacks are still are kind of needed. They are part of a system. While in the colonialist process, the people, the blacks, the Palestinians, are redundant. Because they are redundant, you can completely ignore their ability and need to some economical development, or you even wage economical war against them. And this is what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, not allowing the Palestinians, not the PA, the Palestinians, to develop their economy according to their abilities and talents and skills and needs. I think it has been addressed maybe indirectly, but it has been addressed. And if you look at reports by the World Bank and IMF, they are always urging Israel to allow to develop in area C or to do this or to do that in order to allow the Palestinian economy to stand on its feet. But Israel would not allow for this because that's a weapon. This holding Palestinian economy always at the edge is also a weapon in the hands of Israel.
You have been listening to the intrepid Israeli journalist Amira Haas speaking at the Washington Press Club in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on kkrn.org at 5 p.m. Pacific Time. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.